Opportunity Act of 1974. She is a devoted and able advocate of women's rights, and we welcome her here tonight, Congresswoman Heckler. My good friend, Presiding Officer Bella Abzug, members of the Commission, sisters and friends, picture with me for a moment the case of a young woman lawyer, who one day opened her newspaper and saw an advertisement offering the ideal legal position for her. She had published articles in her law review. She had had valuable training as a novice lawyer, and she sought an interview with this firm. She was interviewed. During that period, the hiring partner of the firm said, "Your credentials are impeccable. You have every right to be proud of your record, but this firm will never hire you. Your legal record has one fatal flaw. You are a mother." I was that young lawyer and that young mother, and I come before you tonight as a pro-family, God-fearing, God-loving woman. And I come before you as well as a member of the IWY Commission, as a supporter of the legislation which produced this conference, and as a strong advocate for the ERA. Great diversity in this audience tonight. If each of you were to give me a profile of your background, we would know of your uniqueness, because the American woman is generally a composite of unique characteristics. Just as the women in Congress are unique and different from each other, this year, for the first time in the United States Congress, 15 of 18 congresswomen have joined together to form a caucus, of which I am proud to be the chair with Congresswoman Liz Holtzman. The caucus of congresswomen transcends philosophical differences. It transcends regional barriers, transcends age and other considerations. We search for the common ground in which we can advance the cause of women. As the woman who has spent in this Congress the greatest period of time in that very venerable institution, I must tonight share with you my concerns for the basic issue of women's economic equality. As a member of the Joint Economic Committee, we have held extensive hearings on the issue of economic equality for women. This is a society committed to equality and committed to fairness as part of our democracy. We have put certain laws on the books which are designed to promote equality. We have one such law, known as the Equal Pay Act. I'm sure you're all familiar with that law. Are you familiar with the inadequacies of that law? As a matter of fact, in 1963, because at that time it was discovered by the Congress that women received 60% of the pay of men in that society, the equal pay law was put on the books. And now in 1977, what is the disparity? 57%. We have hardly gained any ground. More important than that, we have the question of the enforcement of the equal pay law. And this is done by an agency that is known as the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, is overstaffed, it's understaffed, overworked, and unfortunately, virtually ineffective. Why? Why is this the case? Because they are overloaded with a backlog of cases. The backlog before the EEOC at this time is over 130,000 cases. Is that equal justice for women? And in fact, I had this very statistic become a personal concern in my congressional office when a visitor from Massachusetts came and told me of her plight. She's a college professor who has taught on a faculty for 15 years. On that faculty, she published articles. She presided at community events and represented the university on many occasions. The end result of this was that she found, much to her shock, that her salary was $10,000 less than that received by her male colleagues. Now, what is this woman to do? You might say she can file a claim with the EEOC, a logical approach. However, this woman happens to be 57 years old with a backlog of 130,000 cases. Will her case be heard, be considered during her working career? I suspect not. And then let us look at the venerable institution of Social Security, the law to which all of our older citizens count for their security, for their insurance, for their comfort in their later years. What does the Social Security law provide for women? The inequities in Social Security against women are so vast that this year the Congress attempted to try to reduce them by passing amendments to curtail these inequities in the House version of the bill. What did the Senate do about inequities against women in the Social Security law? The Senate removed all of the judicious provisions inserted by the House. What is wrong with this Congress, with these laws that supposedly promote equality and that fail to promote justice? There is a single lacking ingredient. The lacking ingredient is commitment. There is no commitment to equality for women in this Congress. The question is there a commitment for women's equality in this society? We certainly have the rhetoric to stand behind our democratic ideals. Do we have the results to show that our rhetoric is genuine? We are living in an age of enormous hypocrisy, where we mouth certain standards and we deny them with every act. It is in the pocketbook that the American woman is most jeopardized. There are two ways in which this can be addressed. We can continue to work on the body of laws presently before the Congress. And if we were to continue to prop up the Equal Pay Act and to try to expand the Equal Opportunity Commission and to try to reform the gigantic Social Security Act to which the Congress has no commitment for women, how far would we go? it seems to me that attempting a piecemeal approach is rather like the infancy of flying. When man invented the flying machine, he first started to take wings, flaps on his hands, using his own power in an attempt to gain the ability to fly in space. He learned that that wasn't successful, and then man turned to another power, the engine, and combining the engine with the wing structure, he was indeed able to soar. We have the basic laws in this society that can allow women to achieve their aspirations. How are we going to give women the opportunity to soar to equal justice? There is only one way. That is by an amendment to the Constitution. The piecemeal solutions which have been proposed will merely perpetuate the inequities in the current system. The Band-Aid approach will not cure the central disease. We must attack the problem at its core. If we believe in equal justice for all, under law, as the inscription on the Supreme Court recites, then we must make that equal justice a part of our law. Our country can do this. America has put men on the moon. America can put women in the Constitution. There is no other way but ERA now. Our final speaker is Helvi Sipilas, who is Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and an ardent champion of the rights of women in underdeveloped countries. Mrs. Sipilas is the highest ranking woman in the United Nations Secretariat and was a prime mover of the United Nations International Women's Year in 1975. A citizen of Finland, Mrs. Sipilas is the former president of Zanta International. I would also like, on behalf of the Commission, to take this occasion to welcome the distinguished group of women guests from abroad who have been traveling around the United States and are now observing our deliberations here.
Madam Chairman, Chairperson, my dear friends, 2 years ago, at the end of the International Women's Year, there was a cartoon in a press in Finland. This cartoon showed me, the Secretary General of the International Women's Year, washing up dishes and perspiring, and my husband sitting in a rocking chair reading a newspaper and saying to me, "Now, Helvi, it's the end of the year. Go to the fridge and bring me some beer." When I had a press conference in Helsinki at the beginning of 1976, I said, "There is at least one person who will be very disappointed when I tell that when the year was over, the decade started, and that is the cartoonist. And here we are in the decade of which you are a part, and we have to look backward and we have to look forward. The 129-year-long history of the role of women of the United States, from the first nationwide meeting at Seneca Falls to today's national conference, is the American version of a global story of changes in the status, situation, and role of women who have all shared the common fate. For thousands of years, most of the world's women have lived in societies structured and dominated by men as dependents whose value was in their reproductive capacity and in their labor. Traditions and customs, constitutions and laws all bear evidence to this. Women who were bound to their restricted roles by circumstances or lack of awareness or lack of choice, and whose situation remained the same through centuries and generations, were hardly aware of any possibility for change. In this respect, the first meeting at Seneca Falls in 1848 was a great contribution to a new development in the status and role of women in many societies, in many fields. Look at the situation 1848. No woman in no country had political rights. Women had very limited access to education and not at all to higher education. Women had very limited opportunities in the economic field. Women, and especially married women, had an inferior status in civil law. Much has been changed, also slowly, but we have to be grateful to your country for having paved the way for many changes, and we have to be grateful to women in the Western Hemisphere who brought the principle of equal rights to the United Nations Charter. The proclamation of the International Women's Year 1975 and the present decade for women are direct results of the work of the United Nations and especially its Commission on the Status of Women. One difference between the past efforts and today's efforts is the fact that governments nowadays realize that unless there will be changes in the situation of women, political, economic, social and cultural targets of development will not be met. The situation and needs of the 2 billion women of the world are varied both in kind and degree. These differences became increasingly clear during the International Women's Year. Some of us in the industrialized countries have our main emphasis on the equality of men and women. Women from the developing countries, where over 70% of the world's population lives, emphasize the fact that without changes in the situation of women and development, there will be no future for humanity. In many ways, International Women's Year was a pioneer year. It was a year for fact-finding and for planning. Now the decade is a decade for action. And we have a World Plan of Action, which is the first socio-economic and political plan which women all over the world, men and women all over the world, have ever had together. It was drafted by women. It was adopted at a conference where women formed majority, and perhaps this is the reason why it's so practical. National action is naturally the most important one, and this is why your action here is important for your country, but it's equally important for every other country, because we are interdependent. The Decade for Women is an unprecedented challenge and test for women all over the world. It offers unlimited opportunities for women to become real partners with men in their own societies and in the world at large. Our interdependent world is faced with an increasing number of problems which cannot be solved by any country alone. They require joint efforts. And in many of the problem areas, women can play the key role. The quality of life of all people and the future of humanity depends on the action of hundreds of millions of women. Their behavior and their action is of crucial importance in bringing new life, in the maintenance of life, and in assuring the human rights and basic needs of everyone. I would like to say to you, my friends, it depends on you and us and hundreds of millions of other women what the future of women, men and children in the world will be. And we need each other. And in conclusion, I would like to say, I wish that this National Conference of Women of the United States, once again, as it was in the Seneca Falls, will be an inspiration and a unifying factor for all women in the world in our joint endeavor to assume increasing responsibilities for the development of our nations and our world, and for the peace and security of humankind. Thank you.
The chair recognizes, for the purpose of placing a resolution before the body, Commissioner Alice Rossi.
Madam Chair, I move the adoption of the following resolution on education. The President should direct the vigorous and expeditious enforcement of all laws prohibiting discrimination at all levels of education, and oppose any amendments or revisions that would weaken these laws and regulations. Enforcement should apply to elementary, primary, secondary, post-secondary, graduate, vocational and technical schools, including sports and other programs, and the granting of scholarships and fellowships. Federal surveys of elementary and secondary schools should gather data needed to indicate compliance with federal anti-discrimination laws. And these data should be collected by sex as well as race and ethnicity. The Civil Rights Commission should conduct a study to evaluate the enforcement of laws prohibiting sex discrimination in physical education and athletics, and to consider the usefulness and feasibility of per capita expenditure in physical education and athletics as a measure of equal opportunity. Leadership programs for working women in post-secondary schools should be upgraded and expanded, and private foundations are urged to give special attention to research on women in unions. Bilingual vocational training, educational and cultural programs, should be extended and significantly expanded with particular attention to the needs of Hispanic Americans, Native Americans, Asian Americans, and other minority women. State school systems should move against sex stereotyping through appropriate action, including 1, review of books and curriculum, 2, pre-service and in-service training of teachers and administrators, 3, non-sexist counseling at every level of education, with encouragement of women to increase their range of options and choices to include both non-traditional and traditional occupations, and to increase the understanding of women's rights and status in various occupations.
Chair recognizes microphone 2.
Not on. My name is Debbie Benzel and I'm from Maryland. I strongly endorse this plan. Youth are the future of our country, and only through truly non-sexist equal opportunity education. If we can achieve equality in education, we will also be taking great steps towards equality in other areas. Just one example of this is in employment. Employment opportunities many times are based on educational backgrounds, which is presently both inadequate and biased with regards to women. I urge very strongly for you to vote for this, both for youth and the future of our society.
Microphone 4 for a procedural motion. Microphone 7. Ellen Gay Detlefson, Pennsylvania, an educator and delegate at large to this conference from the American Library Association, on whose Committee on the Status of Women I sit. I and my 2 official observers ask you to vote for this education plank in the National Plan of Action. Librarians are heavily involved in and committed to education, but librarianship is a traditionally female profession. 80% of American librarians are women. School librarians have an even higher percentage of women. Yet 80% of those who hold administrative positions in American libraries, including school libraries, are men. Passage of this plank will help us in our struggle for equal opportunity for women in librarianship and in schools. The 35,000 members of the American Library Association join me and my colleagues from the Committee on the Status of Women in Librarianship in asking your support. Vote yes now for education and for libraries. Microphone 2.
I'm Geraldine Reinhart from Ohio delegation. Education is concerned, we'd like to upgrade the education, have better teachers and so forth. And the point I want to make very clear is that how is it best to do this? And if we have the federal government do this by force, then of course we're giving up our freedoms, and it will be so much better to have people do this in a voluntary way. And I think we should consider this as well as all the other resolutions very, very carefully before we allow our freedoms to be taken away and given to another source, to a federal government. And if we do this, of course, then the federal government will have the right to force these things to be done. And in a free country, that is not the way it should be done. And I would urge each member of this delegation to think very seriously about this and other proposals made by the convention before we allow these freedoms to be taken away from us.
Is a motion to amend that was read by the New York delegate Amy Swerdlow. It is as follows. After review of books and curriculum, the following words, the integration into the curriculum of programs of study that restore to women their history and their achievements and give them the knowledge and methods to reinterpret their own life experience. Question is before the House on this motion to amend. All those in favor of the amendment, please rise. Amendment, please rise. The amendment carries. Please be seated. All those in favor, please rise. Please be seated. All those opposed to the resolution as amended, please rise. Please be seated. The resolution is adopted.